Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
if you are uprooted and have come to belong,
welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Crosspoint, a version of today's passage that we're going to read that all have very different details that can be found in all four Gospels, which are the books that give accounts of the life of Jesus. Today, I'm going to be reading from the account found in the Gospel of John. And as we read it together, or as you listen, I want you to pay attention to what from the text grabs your attention. So here we go. John chapter 12, verses 1 through 8. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, the home of Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. There they gave a dinner party for him. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those reclining with him. Mary took a pound of costly perfume made of pure nard, anointed Jesus' feet, and wiped them with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, the one whom was about to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. He kept the common purse and used to steal what was put into it. Jesus said, "Leave her alone. She bought it so that she might keep it for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me." So did anything catch your attention? Maybe you noticed, at least in this version of the story, one of the hosts of the dinner party is Lazarus, who actually just a chapter before had been officially dead until Jesus called him out of his tomb. I imagine this was a celebration for him, and I imagine Lazarus probably preferred the smells of the home-cooked meal and the spilled perfume to that of the rot that he'd experienced and just come out of. Perhaps you noticed Martha, who's once again described as the one doing the serving, while others sat and enjoyed each other's company. Perhaps you noticed the woman who interrupted the party and is called Mary. In other accounts, Jesus tells her that her act will be remembered forever. But this is the only version of the story where the author bothers to tell us her name. Perhaps what stood out to you was the quality of the perfume or the nard, which is really more like an essential oil. And the perfume was believed to have been brought down from the Himalayan mountains, making it incredibly rare and really expensive, which also raises questions of how Mary could afford it and how she acquired it. Perhaps it's not the quality that caught your attention, but the quantity. The narrator is careful to tell us that the amount of perfume in the jar is a lot. It was unusual. It was a really a lot of cologne or perfume. This right here is a bottle of my son's relatively cheap cologne. This bottle is 1 ounce. You would need 16 of these to equal the amount that Mary spilled on the feet of Jesus. One or two squirts of this stuff, and you can smell any middle schooler coming from a mile away. I can still smell it on my fingers and I haven't done anything. Imagine a room full of middle school boys who chose Axe body spray instead of a shower, and you might get close to what the room might have smelled like. So the smell of the perfume, of Mary's perfume, likely permeated everything, not just her hair and Jesus's feet, but the nostrils of everyone in attendance. There was so much of it that it overpowered the smell of the simmering dinner, the baking bread, the body odor of the people in that room. There would have been no getting away from it. for days, maybe even weeks afterward. Those who had been in attendance would have caught a whiff, like my fingers, of that smell and remembered what an unusual dinner party it had been. Just imagine a mess. A pound of perfume doesn't stay neatly under anyone's feet. It would have spread across the floor, into the floorboards, over the rugs, under the feet of the other people sitting at the table. That amount of perfume doesn't easily wipe up either, especially not with someone's hair. It would have taken a lot more than a deep cleaning to be rid of it. Perhaps it wasn't the perfume or the smell that caught your attention. Perhaps it was the description of Judas as a thief who stole money from the disciples' treasury. Although in the other accounts, it's not Judas, or not only Judas at least, who protests the revenue lost by this woman's act. If we're honest, at least on the surface, Judas, the disciples' treasurer, was displaying conduct we typically admire in a treasurer or a financial advisor, those people we trust to keep us on a budget, to remind us what we have, what we've spent, what we still need. Those are the people that give us investment options and the bottom line, and that's why they're good at their jobs. Maybe Judas was really good at his job. But it does seem that Judas did not only use his treasury role with the group's best interests at heart. Early Christians taught that Judas's actions could be explained because he was greedy. Whether this was an underlying character trait for Judas, or maybe something that took him over after he became keeper of the coins, we may never know because we don't really have his side of the story. Maybe he was plagued with anxiety every time the coffers dipped below budget. Maybe he needed funding for a sick relative. Perhaps he just liked the feel, the full purse, and the sound the coins made in his treasury bag. Regardless, it seems that it was greed that ultimately clouded his judgment and ultimately overcame him until he could no longer see or hear the needs of people. Just the constant clinking or lack of clinking in the coin's purse. Judas's protest, though, over Mary's act, prompted Jesus to recite one of the most well-known phrases about the poor in the Bible. You might have caught it. You always have the poor with you, but you won't always have me. So Jennifer Tuttle and I, our Crosspoint student pastor, we had the privilege of attending a women's preaching conference a few weeks ago, and it was delightful. One of the first speakers invited us to work with this same passage that we just read through a variety of interactive activities. And one activity invited us to step into the passage by acting it out. Everybody was picking a role, and because no one else stepped up, I volunteered myself for the part of Mary. And I quickly realized my mistake because I lack the hair necessary to adequately wipe anybody's feet. So I quickly had to decide how dedicated I was going to be to the role. I went for it for at least 30 seconds. But to get my hair close enough to wipe fake Jesus's feet, my cheek had to basically be on their Converse tennis shoe. I could smell the detergent of their socks. I could smell the cleaner that had been used on the floor. If I looked up a little, I could see the gum on the bottom of the chair. I also worried that I was showing too much of my backside to the rest of the group as I folded myself into the shoes of this other woman whose name I actually didn't even know yet. It didn't feel beautiful to me. It felt humbling. It felt uncomfortable. And as I sat there with the other women, acting out the parts above me that I couldn't even see because my face was to the floor, what caught my attention in the text wasn't the smell of her shoes or the floor. It was Jesus's words, "The poor you will always have with you." And as I knelt on that floor, that phrase repeated over and over in my mind. And I thought, how humbling and how vulnerable this situation must have been for this woman, Mary. But also, how humbling, how vulnerable is it to be a person experiencing poverty? Because like the perfume that permeated every inch of the room to the poor, poverty is an all-consuming thing. Poverty can be described as the inability to afford basic life necessities. The sociologist and author Matthew Desmond, who I'll reference quite a bit today, adds that it's also a relentless piling on of problems so that the poor constantly live in misery and cannot escape. Being poor is not simply an economic status. It becomes a way of moving in the world where there is never enough of anything. A sick child means time off work. Time off work means less pay. Less pay means a bill doesn't get paid. But which one? Turn off the heat and you have another sick child, or the cold or the heat keeps you from sleeping well at night. The kids don't do well at school. Do you turn off the water, the electric? Do you not pay your car payment? And then how do you get to work? Public transportation adds 2 hours to your commute, which means less time at work. Do you not pay the mortgage or the doctor bill? What if your child gets invited to a birthday party or wants to play an instrument or a sport? What if you get invited to dinner or are supposed to bring something to that office party? What do you let go of to make those things happen? There is never enough time, money, energy, anything really to allow you to get ahead. Unlike homelessness, which also is a part of poverty, we've worked really differently, really hard, I mean, to speak differently about homelessness. For example, we try to no longer say that someone is homeless, but instead that they are experiencing homelessness or that they are unhoused, meaning just in that language that it is a changeable situation. That's not typically the case with the language around poverty. If you don't have enough economic resources to successfully function, you are poor. And we rarely say that you are experiencing poverty, perhaps because it's so normalized and embedded in our culture and society, and we see it all the time, but we don't actually truly believe it can be eradicated. Or perhaps we feel that this is just the way things are. Perhaps thinking of it in this way as a state of being also allows us to subconsciously distance ourselves from it if it's something we're not experiencing. If someone is something and is not just experiencing something, it's a little easier to other them. They are not like me, and I am not like them, and I no longer have responsibility. And you know, I think another reason Jesus' phrase repeated over and over in my mind that day, because we talk quite a bit at Crosspoint about the results and prevention of poverty. I mean, even over just the last few weeks alone, we've interviewed two of our partner organizations that work to alleviate and eliminate the effects of poverty in our area, Habitat for Humanity, Family Promise. We're going to work with people at Thanksgiving and at Christmas. Some of us even gave up sleeping in our beds a few weeks ago to raise awareness for family homelessness in our community. We talk a lot about injustice. We talk about unjust systems of oppression. We talk about the need to love and to give generously. And I've been doing this work a really long time. And I have to say that you are some of the best at these conversations, Crosspoint. You are some of the most generous. But I can't shake the why. Why do we need to talk about this at all? It seems that a lot of us, particularly those of us who grew up in a white Western context and theology, have taken Jesus' phrase, "the poor you will always have with you," and assumed that what Jesus meant is that poverty is just inevitable. But ignoring or accepting poverty or making ridiculous requirements of the poor in order for them to actually escape poverty, it's actually the opposite of what Jesus was trying to say here. This wasn't some sort of grand ancient Protestant work ethic. The phrase, "the poor you will always have with you," was just the first half of a well-known phrase in Israelite law found in Deuteronomy 15. When it was created, the Israelite people were transitioning really from being a mainly nomadic type people who owned no land, who shared most things because they had to. No one really went hungrier than someone else. Manna fell from heaven at the same rate in front of everyone, and everyone had the same opportunity to gather it. When these laws in Deuteronomy 15 were given to Israel, Israel was moving to being a more urban, agricultural people. They were moving from a more egalitarian, naturally egalitarian way of life, that wherever, whatever you owned, you had to be able to carry with you and by necessity share, to a more individualized way of living that involved land ownership, property rights, hierarchy, where whatever you could claim, you could potentially own. This brought about new economic systems, things like loans. Those who held wealth could make loans. They could incur debt that would likely increase their wealth and influence and power. For the less fortunate, the same practice could lead to their ruin. So we see the gaps begin to widen. And so this Deuteronomistic law was set up so as to structure a more equal and just society, so that the rich weren't getting richer at the expense of others, and so that the poor were not caught in an inescapable web of survival. It was set up to break cycles of generational poverty, where debt forgiveness and generosity were valued. Every once in a while, just gave everybody a level playing field. This is the context for Jesus's phrase at the dinner party. And although it might sound completely obscure to us, the poor you will always have with you, it was not to those in attendance, nor was it to the early readers of the gospel. Let me give you a modern day example of what I mean. What would you say or think if I were to say, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me, right? Or something along those lines. Yes. That's just general common knowledge. Even my kids know that. I checked to make sure it wasn't just me. But it's also not just a phrase, is it? Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words may never hurt me. It has a specific context for when and how it's used. It means more than just what is said at the surface level. Jesus listeners would have heard this phrase, the poor you will always have with you. Similarly, they would have immediately completed the rest of it. And the context for where it comes from is important. Deuteronomy 15 says this: however, there need be no poor people among you. For in the land the Lord is giving you to possess as your inheritance, he will richly bless you, if only you fully obey the Lord your God and are careful to follow these commands I'm giving you today. If anyone is poor among your fellow Israelites in the lands, any of the towns of the land, and the Lord your God is giving to you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward them. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend them whatever they need. Give generously to them, and do so without a grudging heart. Then, because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to. And here's Jesus's phrase: there will always be poor among you. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed toward the fellow Israelites who are poor and needy in your land. So let's dig in here. First, verse 4 tells the reader that there actually doesn't have to be any poor in the first place if they follow the systems and structures that have been laid out for them. The verses before and after just lay out this economic and social system that forgives debts, that practices generosity. It was a system designed to eliminate generational poverty, to promote rest and restoration for the people on the earth. But it's almost as if they knew it wouldn't be followed. Verse 7 says what we're supposed to do if we find any poor among us, which according to the previous verses shouldn't exist in the first place. The systems and the practices were done generously and justly. But just in case, the solution to poverty that we're given is summed up in the phrase that Jesus starts at the dinner party: the poor you will always have with you. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed to the poor and the needy in your land. Open-handed. It says right before that, do not be tight-fisted. Make a fist with your hand as tight as you can. Take a look at it. There's very little room for things to come in or to go out. You can only see actually a portion of this really important appendage. Now open your hands. Now, with an open hand, you can touch, create, pick up, catch, hold, make. How might the image of a fist and the open hand apply to poverty? Verse 8 tells us that rather than being tight-fisted, we should be open-handed and freely give the poor whatever they, the poor, need. And literally translated, it means give them what is sufficient for their needs. There's been a lot of discussion then and now about what give them what is sufficient actually means. We argue about it all the time, right? Because who gets to decide what is sufficient? Because what's sufficient for you might not be sufficient for me. What's acceptable access and autonomy for those experiencing poverty? The commentary from Jewish teachers, the Midrash, on this passage is expansive. One rabbinic teaching argues that sufficiency means you must give a person what is necessary to stay alive, but not to enrich them. But according to 16th century Polish rabbi Joel Sarks, the form of one's assistance should precisely match the needs and abilities of the needy person. So this has been interpreted to mean that you must offer whatever gives the person dignity, even if it means a horse to ride on and a servant to run in front of them, if that's what pulls the person back to where they came from and that's what they're used to. There's a story about the rabbinic sage Hillel, and it says he bought a horse for a child in need, and then he ran in front of him for 3 miles until he could find a servant to do it. This was more than just charity. Hillel put his body on the line. One teacher explained it this way. If it's appropriate to give him bread, we give him bread, and this is sufficient for his needs. If it's appropriate to give him dough, we do not give him bread, but rather dough, and this is whatever he lacks. And if it is not acceptable to him to give him bread or dough, but he asks for money because it's his desire to buy food that he prefers, we give him money. And this is to him. The differences here are significant. Bread is immediately useful, but it becomes stale. Raw dough requires more work, but it becomes sourdough starter that can be used to bake many loaves. Money requires even more work, but it can be the best value because it can be stored and used for multiple things. So yet another teaching says that if a person comes across a needy person, they're obligated to fill their lack. But if their own hand doesn't reach far enough to fill the gap, they should reach just as far as their hand can reach. And open-handedness described here, they mostly have the same starting point. The giver having the humility not to assume they know a person's needs better than the person themselves. It means allowing the person in need the dignity of assessing and expressing their needs themselves. You could think of this as not infantizing the poor. This type of open-handedness requires an uncomfortable level of trust on our part, the giver's part, particularly in a society where we've been taught to mistrust those in need. There will always be poor among you. Therefore, be open-handed and give freely. But more than that, if you try to set up and abide by just systems and practices, there shouldn't be any poor among you in the first place. Sticks and stones. Be open-handed. Looking back at the dinner party, Judas's call was really for one-time charity donations. He wanted to sell the perfume and give it to the poor. Jesus's counter was, actually, charity is great and fine and needed, but really, that's not what I'm about. Jesus was suggesting that his mission was the upending and restructuring of the unjust systems and practices that created the poor in the first place. Jesus was saying to Judas, what we need isn't charity, it's justice. Charity, while appreciated, gives and then gets to go home. It's the pleasant smell of the simmering dinner. Justice, on the other hand, puts skin in the game. It gives the horse and it runs in front. And like Mary's perfume, it has to permeate everything so we can't be rid of it. It has to work itself into us so that it gets into the floorboards and deep between our toes and deep inside of us. And the Jesus of generosity and justice is who Mary was anointing at that dinner party. A Christ who called for justice and generosity and open-handedness. And those ideas are what Jesus was killed for just a few chapters later. If you really think about it, few people in history have been killed for calling for charity for the poor. But those who set out to change power systems so that the top and the bottom are a lot more difficult to tell apart, that's when the death threats start coming out. Those kinds of changes are workers' movements and marches for civil rights, for gender and sexual and racial equality. This is the kind of thing Deuteronomy was talking about. And it was the kind of thing Jesus was talking about. What does it mean for us today? Think for a minute. What does it mean to be poor in America today? Is it a number? Is it a feeling? Is it a look? Close your eyes for just a moment and use all of your senses. What images come to mind when you think of poverty? What does poverty look like? What does it smell like? What does poverty sound like? What does it taste like? Is there a face you picture when I say the word poor? You can open your eyes. Would you place my face in the face of poverty? My family was poor. My family experienced poverty when I was a child. We were a family of six, barely at the poverty line. There are many times when food showed up on my door from unknown strangers. And when it did, my siblings and I celebrated because our lunches looked a lot more like everybody else's at school. I went to school dances in borrowed shoes and dresses. We did not have health insurance. Our immunizations were done at the health department. My mom suffered from untreated thyroidism, her body shaking and shrinking for years because she didn't want to spend the money to go to the doctor. You could say that my family was poor, but when compared to others, we weren't. We didn't experience extra hardships because of our race. We always had a roof over our heads. We always had Christmas gifts. We always welcomed others to our table. We always had at least one car that got us where we needed to go. And I don't tell you this about my part of the story because of I need sympathy. I tell you because you would not have known this about me then or now unless you looked a little closer. An image of a family like mine didn't probably show up in your mind today. My father was a pastor, but we were just one of many families that fell into the poverty statistics and is easy to ignore. I've also found over the years, I've noticed that it's often easier to feel compassion and empathy for those living in poverty across the ocean, in developing countries, on our screens when we ask for sponsorship. But we often find it much more difficult to feel those same emotions and that same empathy about the woman holding the sign on the corner, or the family living in the car in Walmart parking lot, or those whose jobs we depend on every day, but who are not given an affordable wage and can't pay their rent. Poverty has a lot of faces. 37.9 million Americans, or one in nine people, live at or below the poverty line in this country. That's 11.5%. Here's a little context. The poverty line for a family of five, which represents my current household, is $35,140 total to pay our mortgage, our gas, our utilities, our healthcare, our food, which feels like we pay that much alone to keep my three teenagers fed. That doesn't account for 27.5% of Americans who live on double the poverty rate, which is about $59,000 for a family of four, but they do not qualify for aid because they make too much. Let's put it a little more perspective on it. Working 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year at $10 an hour only gives us about $20,800. For some more perspective, starting teacher pay in North Carolina is around $37,000. According to the MIT living wage calculator, each adult in a two-parent, two-child household in Wake County needs to earn at least $19.75 per hour. A single parent with one child needs to earn $29.75 an hour to live comfortably, we might say with dignity. A single adult with no children needs to make more than $63,000 in Wake and Durham counties. The United States is the richest country in the world, but has more poverty than any other advanced democracy in the world. And the poverty we're seeing is the poverty that we refer to as deep poverty. Poverty that we thought only existed in faraway places and in sponsorship commercials. But it's no longer the case. And it can feel really helpful. I mean, helpless. We can be helpful. We actually have an incredible amount of government aid earmarked for the poor. And again, I'm grabbing this from sociologist and author Matthew Desmond. A significant amount of that aid for the poor never actually reaches them. Most of that is distributed in the form of block grants that states can use however they see fit. Some states use it for job training, some for abstinence education, some for church camps. If a state can say that a program will reduce poverty, they can spend it there. When funding finally does reach the poor, it's almost always used to pay bills, which is rarely enough to pull anyone out of poverty. Since 1970s, the bottom 90% of income earners have only seen an annual income gain of about 24%, while the top 1% of earners have more than doubled. But at the same time, living costs, which is food, housing, healthcare, education, they have risen faster than income. So even aid that anyone receives is never going to be enough. The bottom 20% receive about $25,000 in government aid a year. The top 20%, about $35,000 a year in the form of tax breaks, income credits. Why does this cycle continue? Because it benefits me, because it's comfortable, because I have no incentive to change it. A crazy statistic is that during the COVID pandemic, with the child aid credit provided, we cut the child poverty rate almost in half in our country. Since that ended, the child poverty rate is back up to around 12.4%, which is double what it was last year. Desmond estimates that if the government simply collected unpaid federal income taxes from the top 1% in the United States, not raising taxes, just receiving what's actually owed, it would bring in around $175 billion a year, which according to some would almost completely fill the United States poverty gap. It's also been shown that the further one is removed from poverty, the more wealth and resources and power that we have, the less we're willing to invest in ending poverty. Desmond puts it like this: if you're a family of means, you have the incentive to rely less and less on the public sector. So we used to want to be free of bosses, but now we want to be free of bus drivers. We don't want to take the bus. We don't want to enroll our kids in the public education system. We don't need to play in the public park or swim in the public pool. We have our own clubs, our own schools. We have our own cars. And as we withdraw into the private opulence, we have less and less incentive to invest in public service. Paraphrasing, those of us who take the mortgage interest deduction are also more likely to vote against affordable housing proposals. Those of us who already have employee-sponsored health insurance, which is very highly government-subsidized, we are less likely to vote for things like the Affordable Care Act. In other words, the more we have, the less we seem to care. More gives us less and less incentive to be open-handed, which continues the cycle of poverty, which sounds a lot like the conversation that Judas and Jesus were having at that dinner party. And I want to reiterate what I said at the beginning. You, Crosspoint, are some of the most generous and most compassionate people I know. And it is us, the generous and the compassionate, who understand what changes have to be made. Because often we blame the poor for their own poverty. Again, in order to get to the root of poverty in America, we have to look beyond the poor. Martin Luther King Jr. said it this way: a true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It seems to me that what Jesus is getting at is that the strategy in Deuteronomy, the strategy mentioned by Jesus, might be a good starting point. This open-handedness. It's not going to solve it all, but it gets our foot in the door to rethinking what poverty looks like, what it can look like, and what the root cause of it is to begin with. And when we understand that, we can begin to dismantle it. So if you're able, I want to invite us into an activity today, a reflection. If you can, look at your hand for a moment. Really examine it. The lines and the wrinkles and whatever else is on your hand. The adult human hand, it's remarkable. It's complex. It's really delicate. It's made up of 27 bones, and combined together, it's more than any other bones in the human body. About a quarter of all of our bones, our body's bones, are found in our hands. But our hands are also really vulnerable. They get caught on things, they get smashed in things. Many of our bones in our hand are thin. There's tendons and blood vessels and nerves, but they're all just protected by a thin layer of skin and then muscle and fat. We also use our hands a lot, and there's a tendency to injure them, so they feel really vulnerable. This feeling of vulnerability may be why, when we're scared or afraid or anxious or hurt or angry, we tend to close our hands, ball our fists, or clench our fists in response. Because fists can offer protection too, right? It can be difficult to keep our hands open when we're feeling vulnerable. Now move your fingers around a little bit. If you can, close them into a fist. It's much more difficult to make a fist than it is to be open-handed. Closed fists invite tension, beginning at the wrists, the fingers, the joints, and the hands. If you clench your fists a little tighter, you might begin to feel the tension rise into your forearms. If you have longer nails, perhaps they're beginning to press uncomfortably into your palm. The longer you hold a clenched fist, you might begin to feel tension rising into your elbow, all the way up to your shoulders, into your neck, into your upper back. In fact, it can take quite a bit of work to clench your fist and not allow that tension to rise. Everything seems a bit more dire and urgent with your fist closed. Go ahead, clench your fist just a moment longer, a little bit tighter. Now slowly, one finger at a time, gently begin to release and open your hands. You can feel the tension in your hand release almost immediately. You might start to feel the tension in the rest of your body begin to release. You might begin to feel the coolness of the air on your palm. It might feel like the tension of your body is leaving through your fingertips. Take a minute to clench and unclench your fists. As you do, I want you to think about what open-handedness might mean to you. Maybe it means reassessing our personal wealth and generosity. Maybe it means having a generosity of spirit, beginning to reprogram our ideas of who is experiencing poverty, what is causing it, of rethinking what it actually means to live in a cycle of poverty. Maybe open-handedness means that we're being honest about our own tight-fistedness. Open-handedness may mean vulnerability. It may mean releasing the preconceived notions. It may mean putting ourselves in the places where we elevate the needs of the poor over our own accumulation. It might mean speaking up or speaking out. It might start with gathering more knowledge. And we'll put some links up for you to be able to do that. Being open-handed might mean getting involved in acting in justice organizations and speaking up in giving more, in taking less, so that others might have more. Open-handedness might mean that we rethink our giving, that when someone asking someone if they need bread, dough, or money, and giving them what they ask for, and then staying out of it. It might mean trusting. Open-handedness may mean allowing the agency of the poor to make decisions for themselves. It also might mean we assess our proximity to the poor. That we might from time to time find ourselves with more, that we begin to fight the tendency to clench our fists and pull our resources away from those who need it most. It may mean offering assistance with no expectation of anything in return. Open-handedness may mean that we need to work to give a human face to poverty, to remember that is more often than not the systems and the structures that are in place that are the root cause of poverty, not the individual who has found themselves suffering from it. It might mean engaging all of our senses. Sight, smell, sound, taste, touch, as we go about our day in order to recognize poverty around us and how we might be involved in addressing it. Relax your hands. Let's end with a prayer. God, make us more aware and open to complexities around us. Allow your love and essence, like Mary's perfume, to permeate us so that we recognize you in the face of others, so that we might recognize their humanity and fight for their dignity, regardless of their wealth status. Help us strengthen our hands so that they might be stronger when they are open. Teach us to recognize, to humanize, to love, to act. Teach us to be open-handed. Amen.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.